king clearly, seeing the king clearly. So if you wouldn't mind turning in your Bibles to Mark chapter 8. You'll find that on page 1011 of your church Bibles, bottom right-hand corner, Mark chapter 8. I'm going to start reading from verse 22. Okay, great. Let's hear God's word together. Mark 8, verse 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spat on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, "Don't even go into the village." Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Because whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." Let's bow our heads together and ask God to help us. Heavenly Father, we bow before your word, and our prayer is that your word might be our rule, that your spirit, that he might be our teacher, that he may open our eyes and our ears, and that your honor and your glory would be our supreme concern, for his name's sake. Amen. Well, please have that passage open in front of you. Seeing the King clearly is our topic for this afternoon. Way back in the 1970s, the English author and social critic Os Guinness wrote that every generation is apt to see Christ in its own image and produce its own plastic Christ, by which he meant a picture of Jesus pressed through the sieve of its own assumptions and set solidly in the mold of its own values. A Jesus pressed through the sieve of our generation and set solidly in the mold of the values of this generation. And many people today reject the Jesus of the Middle Ages, for example, or perhaps the more recent Victorian era. But the selection of Christ on offer leaves much to be desired. They're not much better. For example, in the late 1980s, noted filmmaker Martin Scorsese directed a movie that saw the Christ as a man tormented over whether he should die on the cross or get married and have a family. Scorsese's Jesus ends up marrying and having a family with Mary Magdalene, as well as Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus. The way Scorsese saw Christ was arguably so flawed that one reviewer remarked that his Jesus was a recent graduate of the Shirley MacLaine School of Theology. For those of you who don't know, Shirley MacLaine is an American actress and author well known for her New Age beliefs and interest in spirituality and reincarnation. Of course, this way of seeing Jesus, the Christ, was rehashed more recently by Dan Brown in his book, The Da Vinci Code. So the question I think I want to ask you this afternoon, and which I think is the question being addressed in our passage from Mark's Gospel that we're looking at, is this. The question is, how clearly do you see the real Jesus, the real Christ? How clearly do you see the Christ? Apparently, at the beginning of his film, Scorsese has a personal disclaimer stating that his film is not based on the Gospels, i.e. Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. In addition, several critics have accused Dan Brown of distorting and fabricating history. Yet you and I can be pretty confident that what we are looking at this afternoon is both trustworthy and reliable history. Now, admittedly, we don't have Mark's original gospel to compare the book we now call Mark's Gospel. We can't compare Mark's original to what we now have as Mark's Gospel. But this is to be expected because ancient documents like Mark's Gospel would have been written on papyrus or on parchment, which would eventually rot or decay over time. For this reason, historians assess the reliability of copies of any ancient manuscript, any ancient document, using three questions. First, how old are the copies currently in existence? Secondly, what time has elapsed between the writing of the original documents and the production of the copies that we now have in existence? And thirdly, how many copies are currently in circulation? When we ask these three questions of Mark's Gospel and compare our answers with other ancient manuscripts, whose reliability, by the way, is not in doubt or in question, we discover that Mark's Gospel, like much of the Bible, stands up extremely well. Indeed, if we're going to doubt what is written in the Gospels, then, for example, we should doubt whether Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great even existed. So you can see when you compare the Gospels to Caesar's Gaelic Wars, the time frame between the original is something like over 800 years, nearly 900 years. How many copies do we have? 10. Compared with the Gospels, we see that we do much better, and we have many more copies of the Gospels. But you can research that kind of thing for yourself without taking my word for it. But listen to how one skeptic put it. After personally trying, as a skeptic myself, to shatter the historicity and validity of the scriptures, I had to conclude that they actually are historically trustworthy. If a person discards the Bible as unreliable in this sense, then he or she must discard almost all the literature of antiquity. I believe we can say the Bible is trustworthy and historically reliable in its witness about Jesus. That's a man called Josh McDowell who did extensive research into this very question. If you disagree, then I challenge you to prove otherwise. Now, not only is Mark's gospel trustworthy and reliable, on closer inspection, it becomes clear that Mark has carefully arranged his material in order to help his readers understand who Jesus is, why he has come, and what might be a reasonable response to him. And I believe all three of these questions are addressed in our passage today, because Mark chapter 8 is pivotal in our understanding of Mark's gospel. Act 1, or the first 8 chapters of Mark's gospel, reach their climax in the passage I read to you a few moments ago. And to help us answer the question, how clearly do you see the real Jesus? I believe God, through his word here today, is saying two things. The first is this: as strange as it may sound, the first thing is this. It's not enough to see Jesus as your king. It's not enough, as you sit here today, to simply see Jesus as your king. I don't know where you stand, where you are on your journey of faith, if you have faith, but you need to know it's not enough to see Jesus as your king. On its own, that's not enough. One of the things that gives credibility to Mark's gospel is the way the first disciples of Jesus are depicted as being so slow to both hear and see, or to understand what Jesus has been teaching them throughout Mark's gospel. If I were Peter, James, and John, or one of the other disciples, I would have got Mark to edit out a lot of stuff in Mark's gospel, because it makes me look bad. The most obvious explanation as to that these things remain in the gospel accounts is, well, they must have been a true reflection of what really happened. Now, earlier in the chapter, and in discussion with his disciples, Jesus is provoked by them to say the following. Look at chapter 8, verse 17 with me. Verse 17. After having a conversation with his disciples, Jesus says this: do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Verse 18. Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember? And then he goes on to recount some important events to them. And then we read further down in verse 21, he said to them, do you still not understand? You can almost hear the exasperation in Jesus' voice. Now, interestingly enough, just prior to this conversation with his disciples, Jesus miraculously heals a deaf man. Chapter 7. Verses 33 to 35. And then after this conversation, Mark also records Jesus healing a blind man in the passage I just read for you a few moments ago. Mark 8, verses 22 to 26. In other words, it's as if Mark is telling us that for these disciples of Jesus to hear and see him, or properly understand who he truly is, they will need a miracle, not unlike the two miracles on either side of the conversation in chapter 8, verse 17 and 18. You see, of course, the problem is that although the disciples can physically see and physically hear Jesus, spiritually speaking, they are as blind and deaf as the two men healed by Jesus in chapter 7 and chapter 8. You see, blindness and deafness are being used by Mark as a metaphor of the disciples' lack of spiritual insight or understanding. See, often in the Bible, such a person is described as having a hard heart, as in chapter 8 and verse 17. And this is a problem we all face in this room. Dare I say, even those of us who would claim to be Christians. Perhaps you're not a Christian here this afternoon. And that's okay, you are very, very welcome here among us. But you need to know that the only reason anyone in this room, myself included, can see Jesus for who he truly is, or hear him speaking through his word, is because just such a miracle happened to us. Jesus opened our blind eyes and unblocked our deaf ears to the truth of who he is. That, by definition, is what it means to be one of his followers. He gave us the understanding we so desperately needed so we could both hear and see him more clearly and more truly. You will almost certainly, if you are not a Christian here today, need to humbly ask him to do the same for you if you are not a follower of King Jesus here as you sit here today. In other words, don't let pride stop you from asking Jesus for the spiritual help we all need without exception if we are to truly hear, see, or understand the truth about Jesus. It's not about being intelligent. It's not about being clever. It's about being in spiritual darkness and understanding and being powerless to perform a miracle on yourself. Now, according to verses 14 to 21, the disciples of Jesus are clueless. They pretty much don't get or understand anything. They are, as we used to say, duh, disciples. In verses 22 to 26, Jesus then heals a blind man, and then he has another conversation with his disciples on his way to a nearby village, according to verse 27 and following. Look at verse 27 with me. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Whoa! Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. At last, and despite all the confusion of so many around them, as the spokesman for the 12, Peter declares, finally, they see and hear what Jesus has been saying. "Jesus, we finally get it. We understand that you are the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah." See, in the ancient world, kings were traditionally anointed with oil as a kind of coronation act. Peter and the other disciples have now taken a quantum leap forward in their understanding. In other words, their eyes and ears have been opened. They've been given the ability to understand. "Jesus, you are not just another prophet pointing us to God's kingdom. You yourself are its king. The future is fulfilled and finds its focus in you. We get it. We see it now. We understand. You are the king to end all kings and the one everyone will one day have to answer to. You are the one who will bring God's future into the here and now. We get it. We see. We hear. Finally, we understand." Now notice, Jesus does not deny any of this in verse 30. But he does warn them in verse 30 not to say a word. See that? See, about 100 years earlier, an anonymous Jewish writer explained what the Jewish people expected of their Messiah in these words. "Behold, O Lord, and raise up for them their king, the son of David. Gird him with strength that he might shatter unrighteous rulers, that he might purge Jerusalem from nations that trample her down to destruction. He shall have the heathen nations to serve him under his yoke." You see, the mere mention of the Messiah was enough to ignite nationalistic zeal among Jewish men, both young and old. Jesus knew that Peter and the other disciples would have been greatly influenced by this violent and politically motivated expectation of what the Messiah would be like. But at best, you see, here's the point. At best, this way of seeing the Messiah was only partially right. It wasn't the complete picture. Peter and the other disciples have come to see something for the first time, yes. But they still don't see clearly enough yet. That, I think, is Mark's point. You see, the big question raised by the healing of the blind man in verses 22 to 26, just before this, is why does Jesus heal this man in two stages? Have you ever wondered that? Mark is the only gospel writer to include this two-stage healing miracle. What I mean is, in chapter 4 of Mark's gospel, Jesus calms a raging storm using just two words. In chapter 7, he heals the daughter of the Syrophoenician woman without even being in the same room with her. In fact, as far as we know, he probably wasn't even in the same village as the girl. He just said it and boom, it happened like that. Yet here in Mark chapter 8, verse 23, after touching the blind man, Jesus asks him if he sees anything. And in verse 24, the man recognizes people, but they look like trees walking around. In other words, he doesn't see clearly. Strange. Surely Jesus can't be having trouble healing someone, can he? No. I believe Mark is using this miracle as a kind of acted parable that is symbolic of where Peter and the other disciples have reached in their understanding. They know Jesus is the king, but they don't yet see clearly the kind of king Jesus is. In other words, they see that Jesus is God the King, the Anointed One, the Messiah, but they don't understand the kind of Messiah he is. It will take another quantum leap in their understanding, i.e. another miracle even, for them to understand the kind of King Jesus is to be. Look with me what Jesus went on to do for the partially sighted man in verse 25. Once more, Jesus puts his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. That's what needed to happen to Peter and the disciples if they were to understand the kind of king Jesus would be. See, Mark is telling us it's not enough to know that Jesus is your king. You need to know more than that. You need to know what kind of king Jesus is. And that is crucial if you're to be his follower. In an increasingly interconnected globe where volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity are the watchwords, 86% of the respondents of a recent survey strongly agree the world is facing a leadership crisis. Incidentally, when asked which sectors are most trusted for its leadership, religious organizations and governments were at the bottom of the list. While businesses and non-profit organizations or charitable organizations were at the top. There is an old adage, is there not, that we get the leaders we deserve. Perhaps that explains the recent turmoil in the two major political parties here in the UK, as well as the current US presidential election, which has been described as the most bitter election in history. Of course, this is all relevant because it seems to me that both the UK and the US, and indeed the world, has nothing to lose by looking at the leadership offered to the world in King Jesus. But that is because it's not enough to see Jesus as your king. Which brings me to the second thing God in his word is saying to us here this afternoon, which is this. You have to see Jesus as your king whose throne is a cross. You have to see Jesus as your king, yes, but whose throne is a cross. See, immediately after telling his disciples not to tell anyone that he's their king, Jesus goes on to explain what kind of king he will be. Look at verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. The jaws of the 12 would have hit the floor when they heard this. See, according to the Old Testament book of Daniel, the Son of Man was this awesomely divine messianic figure who comes on the clouds of heaven in order to put everything right again. He has sovereign power, we are told. He's worshipped by everyone, and he has a kingdom that would go on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. But here in verse 31 of Mark chapter 8, Jesus says he must suffer. Suffer at the hands of puny humans and be rejected and be killed. What? You and I need to appreciate that up until this moment in the history of the Jews, throughout the whole of Jewish history, no one had ever connected the suffering with the Messiah. Messiah, suffering, no. Of course, Isaiah the prophet spoke of a suffering servant, but no one ever linked the suffering servant with the Messiah. In the last of the Star Wars prequels, Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi screams at Anakin Skywalker, who has become the evil Sith Lord, Darth Vader. You were the chosen one. It was said you would destroy the Sith, not join them. Well, to a Jew like Peter, the Messiah was supposed to defeat injustice and evil, not be crushed by them. And to make matters worse, Jesus' use of the word must in verse 31 suggests that it was his plan to die. It was his intention to die all along. That was his end game, as it were. And according to verse 32 of Mark chapter 8, Jesus was very open and very blunt about this. You could not miss the point. An old Aramaic paraphrase of Genesis 49 verse 10 expresses the kind of hope in the Messiah a first century Jew like Peter would have had in these words. How beautiful is the King, the Messiah. He goes forth and orders the battle array against his enemies and slays the kings along with their overlords. He reddens the mountains with the blood of their slain. His clothing is dripped in blood like a winepress. That was how Peter and the other disciples saw their Messiah. The trouble was, Jesus would indeed be bloodstained, but in his own blood and not in the blood of his enemies. That's the kind of leader King Jesus is. Rather than taking the lives of his enemies, he would die for them. Peter and the others, the 12s, were totally unprepared to accept this sort of Messiah. They were the first in a long line of Jews for whom the cross of Jesus Christ would become a very real stumbling block. So Peter takes Jesus aside and rebukes him in verse 32. The word translated rebuke here in verse 32 and 33 is used later in Mark's gospel to describe Jesus expelling an evil spirit. In other words, Peter is condemning Jesus in the strongest possible terms. Jesus, I'm having none of this. Over my dead body, Jesus, you ain't going to no cross. Peter's problem is expressed well in a poem called Splintered Messiah, by Christian poet Stuart Henderson. Let me read it to you. I don't want a splintered Messiah in a sweat-stained, greasy grey robe. I want a new one. I couldn't take this one to parties. People would say, who's your friend? I'd give an embarrassed giggle and change the subject. If I took him home, I'd have to bandage his hands. The neighbours would think he's a football hooligan. I don't want his cross in the hallway. It doesn't go with the wallpaper. I don't want him standing there like a sad ballet dancer with holes in his tights. I want a different Messiah. Streamlined and inoffensive. I want one from a catalogue, read eBay or Amazon, it was written a while ago, who's as quiet as a monastery. I want a package tour Messiah, not one who takes me to Golgotha. I want a King of Kings with blow waves in his hair. I don't want the true Christ. I want a false one. Yet to think of Jesus as any other kind of Messiah besides the one revealed here in Mark chapter 8 is to be worldly and ungodlike in your thinking. Of course, the ruler of this world is Satan. And his rebellious spirit is at work in all those who insist on embracing a false, streamlined, inoffensive, trendy, crossless Messiah. Of course, no cross means no sin, no wrath, no judgment, and of course, no hell. About 5 decades ago, one Christian theologian described Christianity in these words. A God without wrath brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. And many people, even within the church today, would prefer that sort of Messiah. Only when we see our need as wretched, fallen, broken sinners, only then will we begin to see clearly the kind of Christ we need. But you and I need to see that not only do we need to see Jesus as our King, whose throne was a cross, where he died in our place for our rebellion and wickedness. We also need to see that he calls each of us to live the kind of life that he himself lived. His life becomes the pattern for how you and I should live our lives. Look what Jesus goes on to say to his disciples. Verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. To follow Jesus means being willing to live a cross-shaped life. Verse 34. It will mean dying to my old self. It will mean surrendering to the God-given right of King Jesus to run my life. He has to be involved and have the final say in all the decisions of my life. Who I marry, who I have sex with, the job I do, and how I treat people, how I spend my money or parent my children, what I read and how I think about issues. I have to be willing to have my old ways of thinking and behaving done away with. Crucified, if you like, with Jesus on the cross. If you insist on holding on to the throne of your life here and now, you will end up losing your life in eternity, says Jesus. The great irony of that is that by surrendering your life to Jesus and his cross here and now, you will, says Jesus, save it ultimately. Verse 35. You see, there is nothing more precious than your soul. The person you are when you die is the only thing you will take with you into the world to come. Do you know that? Verse 36 and 37. In 21st century Britain, character is so underrated, isn't it? Yet it is the only part of us that will survive into the world to come. Your character. Who you are as you sit here this afternoon. In 1,000 years from now, it will not matter that you owned your house outright in Broccoli. That you drove a top-of-the-range Mercedes or could afford luxury holidays. It will not matter. It won't matter that you got an Oxbridge degree and a shed load of A-levels and GCSEs. It will not matter that you were rich, famous, talented, good-looking, and a great wit if you end up losing your soul, your very self, in the process. You see, if you are ashamed of Jesus and his cross now, he will be ashamed of you then, verse 38. The cross is not just how you are saved now, it is also how you live now. The story is told of the Irish writer George Bernard Shaw storming out of a meeting where the cross of Jesus Christ was being explained. He left the meeting shouting, "I'll pay my own debts." He went on to write about what he described as Christianity, which he saw as an unwelcome departure from pure Christianity. A religion that has a Messiah who needs to die on an instrument of torture, punished in my place and yours, was something George Bernard Shaw, for all his creativity, utterly despised. The most successful companies spend millions of pounds creating logos, images, pictures and symbols that instantly communicate a brand or product. John can tell you that. For Christians, that symbols, that brand, if you like, is the cross. The cross is like a sparkling diamond that dazzles, amazes, and confounds. When seen, of course, against the jet black cloth of my wickedness and yours, my rebellion and yours, my just condemnation and punishment, and the God who satisfies his own sense of justice by self-substituting himself in my place and yours. Only then does the diamond of the cross sparkle with the brilliance that is truly breathtaking. Only then do we begin to understand why the cross of Jesus the Messiah is the throne from which he will rule the universe. It's not enough to see Jesus as your king. You have to see him as your king, whose throne is the cross, that bids you come, die, and live a cross-centered life. Let's bow our heads as we reflect upon this.